I'm John Weber, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Since Philadelphia rapper Meek Mill was sent to prison for probation violations, his fans have responded. Supportive billboards have gone up. A bus tour with a Free Meek Mill sign has driven around Philadelphia City Hall, and celebrity supporters have spoken out on his behalf. But how does this case provide a window into how thousands of other Philadelphians deal with probation every day? WHYY's Bobby Allen sat down with the city's top public defender, Keir Bradford Gray, to explore this question.
In some ways, Philadelphia rapper Meek Mill going to prison for 2 to 4 years for probation violations is extraordinary. And in other ways, it's not at all extraordinary, right? Before he was sentenced earlier this month, he was one of 45,000 people on probation in Philadelphia. And now, he's sitting in jail for violating probation. He's one of thousands who've been incarcerated for breaking the rules of their probation. In fact, in Philadelphia County, one-third of all prisoners behind bars are there for probation or parole violations. Can you talk about how Mill's jail sentence highlights issues around local mass incarceration?
Absolutely. I think what we've seen in the Meek Mill case is someone who can go to jail for a lengthy term for not committing a new crime, but doing things that were, you know, most would deem mistakes that you shouldn't do, but something that's not worthy of a state sentence in prison.
So the outrage that Meek Mill's punishment has sparked has, I think, left a lot of people asking, how did this happen, right? He was originally arrested for gun and drug charges back when he was 19 years old, and he's been under the supervision of the same judge, Janice Brinkley, since then, so for more than 10 years. Critics of long probation sentences say, if you're on probation that long, it's an arrangement that's kind of bound to fail, right? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I do think if people are on probation for 10 years, they are going to make a mistake, as we stated before. 5-10 years of probation is just – it's really not designed to help people progress. And like I said before, once the court supervision ends, people are on their own. So we have to give them a little bit of freedom and flexibility. Even though they're under the court's watch eye, we should be looking out to whether or not they're in the same position, demonstrating the same antisocial behavior or committing new crimes, not are they perfect. There's no real boundaries in terms of how they can sentence you other than the statutory max of the original charge. And so if he was charged with selling drugs, the statutory max is 10 years. The judge can't sentence him to 11 years, but she can continue to give him 5 years and 5 years and 5 years. And I mean, we have people that are on probation for, you know, decades, and they just can't seem to get from underneath it.
And so your office represents some 10,000 people a year in probation violation hearings, right? Can you walk us through how often someone is sent to prison for violating probation and kind of what those courtroom debates are typically like?
Yeah. So, you know, that's something that we all own in the criminal justice system. And I mean all of us, meaning the defenders, the DA, the judges, as well as the probation officers. When people are in violation, there's not a lot of information about all the progress they've made. And, you know, unfortunately, when people are in violation, we get that information really rapidly, and we have to piece together what has someone done for the entire time they've been on probation, what are some of the pitfalls, what are some of their real life circumstances that would prohibit them from doing everything that they needed to do. And we don't always get that full picture. And so we're trying to do a better job at that by using the community in a initiative called Participatory Defense. So when people are in violation, we'd like to have someone from the community talk a little bit more about who they are and what they've done and what opportunities they may have.
So getting back to Meek Mill, he's signed to Jay-Z's record label, right, Roc Nation. He's amassed a sizable fortune through touring and selling records. His defense team consists of 5 seasoned lawyers who file these time-intensive 70-page motions on his behalf. He has seemingly endless resources and the best legal defense money can buy, right?
Yes. And
some are holding him up as a poster boy for the problems of excessive jail sentences and being micromanaged on probation. You know, in what ways is he really a good example of that? And in what ways is he really not?
Well, in ways that he's a good example is that his case amplifies this problem. So we can talk about it around what happened here and really break it down and say this is not something that's unusual. But in the ways he's not is that he has been treated a lot differently than people that we normally represent on both ends. I mean, I don't see him as the poster child, but I see him as an opportunity to really discuss this problem in a larger, broader sense and that if we want mass incarceration to end, we have to understand what it looks like. And his case does exemplify that.
Keir Bradford Gray, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Keir Bradford Gray is the chief defender at the Defender Association of Philadelphia.
For the past 9 years, around 300 men and women have gathered in Fairmount Park for a rugby tournament the day after Thanksgiving. And it's an unusual tournament. There's no winner, and the organizers don't even keep score. But as WHYY's Jim Saxa reports, the teams play for something greater than a trophy.
All right, we'd like to welcome everyone to the 9th annual Apple Pie Sevens day after Thanksgiving.
It's already a little bit past noon when Bill Sharp gets on the mic. Sharp was supposed to kick things off about 20 minutes ago, but this is a rugby tournament, so we're on rugby time, the jock equivalent of being fashionably late.
So I think, without further ado, let's play some rugby.
Ready, 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 ready. Ready, ready.
There are 20 teams playing in this year's Apple Pie Rugby Sevens tournament, which is held on Black Friday every year in honor of Josiah Sterling, who passed away in 2009.
Josiah loved apple pie.
That's Ryan Gregory, one of Josiah's best friends. They played rugby together at St. Joe's Prep, the Philadelphia all-boys Catholic high school. A year after graduation, they're playing together at a tournament down the shore. After the games, they went to the beach. Gregory was in the water with Josiah's when the rip current struck.
You know, we weren't even in the water waist deep. It was knee deep, and it's just the power of the ocean, the power of water.
Gregory is a strong swimmer and was able to escape the tide's grip. He didn't know Josiah's had never learned to swim. That year, Josiah's teammates started a tournament in his honor. It raises about $10,000 a year, and the money pays for swim lessons at the Salvation Army's Croc Center in Hunting Park. Over 1,100 low-income residents have learned to swim thanks to the tournament. Like all rugby matches, the event has a rain-or-shine policy. They play no matter how bad the weather gets. But today, it's beautiful out. And it is every year, says Bill Gregory, one of the lead organizers.
As you can see, it's late November, and it's sunny and 55. And as I said, Josias was always very coachable. He's in charge of the weather every year. And once again, Josias has come through with a beautiful day.
Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
The infamous MOVE bombing destroyed 61 homes on the 6200 block of Osage Avenue and Pine Street in West Philadelphia. More than 30 years later, the city is still trying to make amends. WHYY's Taylor Allen reports residents of the Cobbs Creek neighborhood are cautious and a bit skeptical of the latest plan.
Ruth Willis has lived near the intersection of 62nd Street and Osage Avenue for almost six decades. She remembers everything from the night of the MOVE bombing, May 13th, 1985.
I could see from the TV where I was staying what was going on, and then I could see where they were at my door. I thought I could come up and just give them the key to open my door, and one of the detectives grabbed me in the middle of the street and said, "No, you can't go there. It's dangerous."
The city initially rebuilt the houses after the bombing, but 36 of those homes were deemed substandard, so the city bought and boarded them up. 17 years later, they're still empty. The Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority picked AJR Endeavors to renovate the houses back in April. Sleeper Freeman has lived in the neighborhood for about a year. She likes the idea of more people living around the blighted area.
We need more people on the block, but to me personally, I think if they rebuild the houses, they should give it to low-income people.
All 36 homes will be sold to anyone who can afford them. Brooke Bronson is a millennial who has lived in the area her entire life. She's supportive of the project, but skeptical of how long rebuilding will take.
You know, it could be good for some people that actually need some place to live, but they need to kind of get a move on.
Ruth Willis is worried she won't be able to afford the taxes on her home, especially if the rebuilt houses sell for $200,000 each, as the developers hope.
We are retired people on fixed income, and new homeowners may be people who are well-employed and cause an effect, especially on taxes. That's the main thing. taxes.
The average listing for a home in Cobbs Creek currently is about $117,000. So 36 homes selling for $200,000 each would raise property values and eventually taxes. Rodney Ross is a partner in AGR Endeavors, the developer picked for the project. He says this will benefit the community and doesn't think taxes will change significantly for homeowners such as Willis.
This is bringing that community back to where it was, to a whole. It's going to be like a major catalyst for that area, Cobbs Creek. Redeveloping that whole block is going to be a big step in bringing Cobbs Creek to where we think it should be.
Both AJR Endeavors and the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority say they are speaking with the community before the work begins in earnest. The PRA and City Councilwoman Janie Blackwell hosted a public community meeting in April when the project was first announced. Gregory Heller is the executive director of the PRA.
We want to work with the community and do what we can to responsibly get these properties renovated and back into active use with new homeowners as soon as we can, while ensuring that it's done to a high standard of construction and in a way that's sensitive to the neighbors and nearby residents.
While sitting on her porch, Ruth Willis remembers how the block used to feel more like a family on Osage and Pine before the bombing. She likes the idea of the empty and shoddy houses turning into a vibrant area.
I would like to see it come together and be a great community where we know one another and be caring and concerned about everyone's welfare.
Work on the project is likely to begin January 2018. Taylor Allen, WHYY News.
Coverage of the Vietnam War in American media and academics typically focuses on U.S. soldiers. For writer Katsi Vilifon, that has also shaped many misconceptions about refugees from Southeast Asia.
There have been mixed emotions for me watching Ken Burns' The Vietnam War. I appreciate that much of it comes from interviews with not only Americans but also the Vietnamese, former soldiers of North and South Armies, the Viet Minh, province chiefs, sons and daughters of government officials. Some names don't even have a corresponding title, just where they're from. These are regular people, and they are retelling their own history. It's a rather welcome change, because studying wars and living through them are completely different narratives. We Americans call it the Vietnam War. However, in Vietnam, it's the American War. For people like my parents, refugees from Laos, also fighting their own civil war, also suffering from a history of French colonialism, Japanese occupation, and U.S. flip-flopping diplomacy, it's not called anything. We don't talk about it, even now. We just accepted what's been said, just like the American public. During my childhood, I had always believed my parents emigrated here, dreaming of a new life, choosing the United States as their new home. Little did I know about the choices refugees get to make. Communists or royalists leave the only home they'd ever known or remain to face soldiers, have me, the firstborn child, in a refugee camp in a country not of their origin, or live in one with an uncertain future. Go elsewhere, not knowing what freedoms would exist for them, or accept being citizens of the very country that made them refugees in the first place. Listening to a history that's excluded them entirely, or being called ungrateful for daring to challenge the government that took them in. It's been over 40 years. What do we get to talk about then? To really understand a war, you'd have to live through it all, or perhaps I should say, survived it. But I doubt that anyone who has ever seen that much wants to relive it. That's not to say you weren't impacted by the war if you weren't inside of it. I was born after the wars ended in 1975. But because my mom gave birth in a refugee camp, my American identity is rooted in my green card status. While my entire upbringing has been American, I've never seen pictures of my parents' youth. Their silence about their life before America only ignites my curiosity about how we got here and why U.S. history lessons about Vietnam did not include Laos or Cambodia. It also leaves me conflicted looking back at the racist neighbors we had growing up in South Philly. And I try to empathize. Maybe they had a brother, father, husband, or uncle who served in Vietnam, who died or returned home missing parts of their body, or came back a different person. While Vietnam War media coverage talked about loss, regret, and failed diplomacy, those families were perhaps trying to salvage some kind of brave memory for their fallen soldier. And the only way they knew how was by resenting my existence, hating that I got to live with my freedom in their America. I know most people grieve in different ways, but that psychological projection is the form I hate the most. driving the false narrative that I, my family, and the approximately 130,000 Southeast Asians resettled as refugees in the U.S., we were all saved by American soldiers. We know that's not true. The unsuspecting villagers, many of them children, whose lives and limbs are still claimed by the unexploded bombs that contaminate 30% of Laos, know that's not true. The American soldiers who flew those planes from 1964 to 1973 in over 580,000 bombing missions know that's not true. After 40 years, does America still care? For those of us watching this documentary now, why are we doing it? Perhaps to get acknowledgement, a little shout-out in such a long saga of American history? It is this psychology my parents have gotten used to. Let them say what they want. What matters is that you are alive. But for me, being alive is what allows for us to make sure that the stories that get told about us are told by us. And when it comes to war, despite how many are fighting, it really only has two sides, before and after. For WHYY, I'm Katsi Vilayfon.
For more commentaries featuring voices from the Philadelphia region, visit WHYY.org. The tug of brick-and-mortar Black Friday enticements may not have the same allure as in years past. Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, joined NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Teller to talk turkey about online shopping in America.
Obviously too early to calculate the numbers from this year, but what's the trend?
We first asked this question back in 1998, where are you going to do your shopping? And this is interesting. 4% said they were very likely to shop online on the internet using a computer. We didn't say smartphone back then, but since then we've added smartphone or tablet to the question. 4%, very likely. In fact, over 80% said not at all. Well, fast forward to today, and you've got half, 48% very likely, and another 17% somewhat likely. And in the same surveys over the years, we have asked about department stores, our poor beleaguered friends in the retail industry, brick-and-mortar department stores. At one point, it was 60%. Who said very likely to shop in department stores, and that's plummeted down now to 35%.
Frank, when did that turnaround take place?
This is the first year we've seen the flip. Now, to be sure, we did not ask these questions between 2013 and 2017, but back in 2013, it was 33% who said they were going to shop online, very likely to do that, and 39% said they were very likely to shop in department stores. So department stores were still winning 4 years ago in 2013, but now, as I mentioned, it's flipped. It's up to 48% online and down to 35% in department stores.
Regardless of where you do your purchasing, how much is being spent?
Well, I can tell you an exact number, about $860. How's that?
That sounds pretty specific.
Indeed it is. We ask Americans to estimate in dollars how much you're going to spend for your holiday gifts this season, and that's the average for all Americans. More important than that specific dollar estimate, though, is that it's usually been a pretty good predictor when we look at the trends, and that is high. In fact, in November, before Christmas, historically, we've rarely seen it this high. Particularly, we haven't seen it this high since before the recession, and it's higher than previous years at this point.
Greater disposable spending folds in with our topic last week about the economy not being the top concern for Americans.
That's absolutely right. We're way down, as we talked about, in terms of the number of mentions of the economy, or any aspect of the economy is our top problem. And presumably, the fact that Americans aren't as worried about the big picture on the economy means they feel a little more comfortable loosening the purse strings and buying a lot of presents.
Now let's move on to loosening the belt loops. Of course, one of the benefits of getting out of the house for holiday shopping is the chance to perhaps work off some of the fixins from the Thanksgiving feast. To what extent are Americans now ready to shed some pounds?
Well, Americans would like to lose weight, and that's one of the interesting things that we find over time. We have, in our survey we just did, about 56% of Americans who say, yes, they would like to lose weight. However, we follow up and ask Americans, are you actively trying to lose weight? And what we find there, it's only about a quarter who say yes. To be a little more specific, 24% of men and 29% of women will admit to us that they're actively trying to lose weight. So that's this huge discrepancy. Twice as many Americans say they would like to lose weight as say they're actively trying to.
Do we have a sense of one's ideal versus actual weight?
The average man in America today says that he weighs 196 pounds, and the average woman in America today says that she weighs 165 pounds. And both of those are near or at the highest self-reported weight that we have tracked. What's interesting is that we follow up and say, all right, how much would you like to weigh? And that's actually been going up too. In other words, the target weight for Americans is also creeping up. The average woman in America today wishes to weigh, would like to weigh, ideally would weigh 142 pounds. And as I just told you, the average woman reports that she weighs 165, so that's about a 22, 23-point discrepancy in pounds. The average man in America today wants to weigh 184, and that's about a 12-point discrepancy between what men tell us they weigh and what they would like to weigh.
Well, then, interesting that women are a little tougher on themselves than men seem to be.
That's right. I'm sure sociologically there are many reasons for this. Culturally, marketing to women, self-image considerations, and why women are more worried about their weight in the sense of wishing they weighed less. But nevertheless, these are the facts I'm laying out before you. Women are less content with what they weigh now than our men.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Banyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. We had help this week from Edward Soskavili. The news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Culinary. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, Adam Stanishevsky, and Bob Alls. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm John Weber for NewsWorks Tonight.